AT&T recently ditched plans to sell phones made by China's Huawei, reporting Tuesday of a warning given to AT&T by U.S. lawmakers strongly urging America's second biggest wireless carrier to stay away from doing business with Huawei. The congressional sources said the alarm went out because national security experts see Chinese involvement in the U.S. telecom industry as a risk to national security.
Swiss food group Nestle has agreed to sell its U.S. confectionery business for $2.8 billion, meaning American household candy brands like Butterfinger and Baby Ruth will be getting a new owner. Italian chocolatier Ferrero, the company best known for its gold-wrapped Ferrero Rocher and chocolate spread Nutella, could be getting a sweet deal. Ferrero beat U.S. chocolate giant Hershey to the deal. Its reward is moving from being the fifth to the third biggest player in the U.S. market.
Steve Bannon, the latest high-profile figure summoned to testify before a House committee as part of its ongoing investigation into allegations that Russia interfered in the 2016 election. The congressional grilling Tuesday comes just a week after Bannon stepped down from his executive chairman job at Breitbart News.
Now, WGN Radio's daily conversation about the life of business and the business of life. This is The Opening Bell with Steve Grzanich on 720 WGN.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the program. Today is Wednesday. It's January 17th, 5:10 in the morning. Glad you're here with us for another edition of The Opening Bell, another business day getting underway. We've got a good show for you today. We have a couple of authors on. We'll talk momentarily about being fully connected is the name of the book. It's about how we're all technically connected with social media, and whether or not this is really becoming a bad thing, if we're overconnected, and maybe even it might be impacting our health. We'll talk with the author coming up momentarily, and a little bit later in the program, How Cities Can Thrive in Populism is the name of a new book called New Localism. Bruce Katz will be here with that. But first, on the WGN Associated Bank Market Desk, futures are pointing toward another opening, strong opening on Wall Street this morning. Dow futures are up 110 points. NASDAQ and S&P futures are higher as well. NASDAQ futures are up about 21 points. Around the globe this morning, markets in Europe are generally lower. The FTSE, the DAX, and the CAC are all just a fraction lower in trading today. And in Asia, the markets are mixed as well, with the Nikkei leading the pack downward, off 83 points, which is about a third. Everything else in positive territory. In Hong Kong, the market is up about a quarter. Oil is trading at about $63.40 a barrel, which is down 33 cents. A couple of stories that we're watching for you this morning. One of them involves the latest on the budget. Again, the deadline is coming Friday for the government to keep operating or shut down without a new budget. The controversy continues over DACA and whether or not to include that in the deal. Yesterday on Capitol Hill, there were more and more lawmakers considering possibly a shutdown that would happen on Friday. And so we'll keep watching to see if there will be any movement in that industry. Also, travel industry representatives sounded the alarm yesterday over a long-term decline in international tourism to the U.S. and said that they want to work with the Trump administration to reverse that trend. Organizers of the New Visit U.S. Coalition said the decline started in 2015 and repeatedly said they're not blaming President Trump, who had been criticized by some in the travel industry for what has been called the Trump slump, with anti-foreign rhetoric and policies. Also this morning, Ford, General Electric rather, will pay $15 billion to make up for the miscalculations of an insurance subsidiary as a new regime weighs future changes that could culminate in a breakup of a company conceived back in the industrial age. The setback announced yesterday is rooted in North American Life and Health, a part of company's GE's capital division that helps cover the risks assumed by insurers that sell policies to consumer. North American Life stopped writing new policies in 2006, but before that, it insured about 300,000 policies covering long-term care of people with financial years of their lives. Are you looking down at your phone right now, checking social media, checking in at the office with email? We are all connected, and our first guest this morning has been writing about it. It's called Fully Connected, Surviving and Thriving in an Age of Overload, and Julia Hobsquam is with us this morning. Julia, good morning. Welcome to The Opening Bell.
Good morning. Hello. I'm speaking to you from London.
Well, wonderful having you, and hopefully it's a beautiful morning or afternoon, I guess, there, close to afternoon. We appreciate you taking time out with us for this.
My pleasure.
The book is one that I think everybody should read because, as I mentioned in the opening, we're all connected, and you argue in the book that maybe it's not healthy anymore.
Yes, I think that in the last 70 years since, say, the World Health Organization came into being, we've really understood how to look after our physical and our mental health. The well-being market is about $3.5 trillion large. Most of us have a literacy and a practice around the way we take care of our mind and our body. And yet, we don't look after what I call our social health, which is the way in which we avoid getting tune out, burn out, infobesity, and struggle with connectedness, which I think is a health problem for individuals and organizations. So whilst I love technology like anybody else, I think it has its limits for the human, and I think we need to talk about that more and take more precise steps to look after it, just like we do our diet, our fitness, and our sleep, for instance.
One of the things that is interesting about this and your story is you have sort of a personal connection to this. Talk to me about, you had a health scare in your life, right?
Yes, 10 years ago when the iPhone came in, when Facebook was really taking off, I was working, I'm an entrepreneur, I run a small business, I was working super hard, I had my young children, and I got pneumonia, which turned into sepsis. And the truth is, I didn't really notice because I was working so hard and always on. And one of the problems of the modern connected age is it's quite difficult to separate out the beginning, the middle, and the end of work, and the beginning, the middle of your other life. And so people can overdo it. So it was that recovery that made me start to think about it. But then I also began to look at the economic metrics. Productivity in the world over the last 25 years since the internet is stalling at best. So the needle on productivity output is not rising with all of this connectedness. So I wanted to write a book which is rooted in the personal, because we are all people, even though we're working, but also looking, if you like, systemically at what can we do about it. And again, what I think we can do about it is to have a strategy around our social health.
It's interesting that you look at productivity in this, because we often think that these technical devices, at least they should, make our jobs easier, and so we should be able to do them better and produce more. That's not the case, is it?
Well, it's not always the case. I mean, I've just come off the British Airways website and app to talk to you because I'm booking some tickets to Berlin. You know, when it all goes smoothly, it's done in 5 minutes and you feel fabulous. When it doesn't go smoothly, you get tangled in the technology, and that's very common. So the first thing is that the technology often elongates the process, doesn't shorten the process. The second is that what gets things done and productivity is also very aligned to creativity, to a holistic engagement with who you are and what you do. And if we start to imagine that just doing more and more and more enabled by computers faster, at more speed, at more scale, that's really a fantasy. The human doesn't really like that. We like to feel connected. I've just joined the Workforce Institute board run by Kronos, the American capital management company, and they're doing some interesting work looking at how shop floor workers feel about technology, because of course they now have their smartphones, so they're very connected to their lives even when they're punching the clock. So we're all affected. It isn't just professional workers.
Julia, hang on with us. We're going to take a quick break here and continue our conversation this morning with Julia Hobswam, the author of Fully Connected, Surviving and Thriving in the Age of Overload.
You're listening to The Opening Bell on 720 WGN.
Good morning. Welcome back to the program. Julia Hobswam is with us this morning, the author of Fully Connected, Surviving and Thriving in the Age of Overload. She's with us via phone from London this morning. Julia, you have an interesting title. You were, I think, in 2011 named an actual professor of networking. And so you're sort of an expert at networking. What would be your tips for all of us to do that better and maybe not be as overloaded and fully connected?
Well, I think the first thing to say is let's talk about the networks rather than the networking. Networking is associated quite rightly with a sort of self-promotional working the room. And it's not really fit for purpose anymore. What people need is not so much to do more networking. They need to have networks. And I really think it's an important distinction. I don't think I'm just sort of nitpicking. What I mean is that the network science that I've studied and looked at and brought in some of the case studies in my book, actually, is that we need diverse networks. We need people that we can trust. We need people that we know, but also we need to reach out and cultivate relationships with people that we might not know so well. So the other interesting thing about networks and indeed networking, that almost the worst type is the huge conference type, where you go for expediency to something that has got maybe 3,000 delegates. That's not the way to network. The way to network is actually in small groups. There's an anthropological maximum number of people, Steve, of 150. So I would say scale down the events that you go to. Make them small. Make them intimate. Make them meet up. But cultivate a network. Actually form and build a relationship with people over time and do away with the idea that it's a quick fix, that, you know, networking is all about handing out your business card. That's very old, hierarchical, siloed. Good networks and networking is about being very lateral. So there are some big changes I'm asking people to make in the way they think and behave around modern connectedness. It's about how we behave online and offline, really, and how we need a real balance and marriage of the two in exactly the same way, coming back to my social health point that, you know, we know if we sit on a sofa all day and eat refined carbohydrate, that's no good for us. So we've learned to change our behaviors. We need to get off the social networks. We need to get off the big conference circuits. We need to start doing stuff differently. And I think the results will be evident.
I know you suggest maybe even going through your list of folks on your network and take one of them to lunch on a regular basis. Ask somebody different out.
Yes, be face-to-face in a Facebook world. I mean, I think that Facebook is making some interesting correctives to its platform, but it is shocking, isn't it, that 50 minutes a day is the amount of time that the average Facebook user spends on that network. And if you think about it, even Elon Musk, who wants to send us to the moon, can't stretch time. We can't stretch time anytime soon. There's 168 finite hours in the week, and a third of those we sleep. So time is really, really precious. And therefore, we need to spend time meaningfully. And even though it takes more time to go and have a cup of coffee or to pick up the phone to somebody that you normally press reply all to on the email, you're probably going to get more bang for your buck time-wise because it's more connected, it's more intimate. So again, we need to sort of reframe and refresh the way we think about how we spend time. Spend more time with less people is basically what I advocate.
And in doing that, some of us, I think, have lost the ability to be social. We ask the wrong questions. We talk about the wrong things. I saw a recent article once quoting you that one of the things that we should not be asking folks when we get into those social settings is, what do you do or how much you make?
Well, look, it's difficult, isn't it? I mean, I'm a sort of making small talk and big talk, whatever the occasion requires. You know, in England, we always talk about the weather. This is very well known, you know. There's nothing wrong with sort of saying, and what do you do? But actually, the most important point of connection comes when you really show the other person who you are in some shape or form. And that might involve saying, I'm having a bad hair day, or I'm feeling very overloaded, or, you know, my stress levels are high. How about you? So as long as you bring yourself to the connection and the conversation, whether that's in a business meeting or whether that's in a party or a conference, the sooner you're likely to actually really connect with someone. And absolutely all the research shows that trust is the highest marker of connection. And if you want to talk in pure business terms about sales, sales follow trust. If you are trusting someone, you're likely to give them the time of day. You're likely to buy their services, or they might buy yours. So it's a virtual and a virtuous circle.
Julie, we only have about a minute left, unfortunately, but I want to ask you, and I know if we're feeling overloaded with all of this, you actually take a break from it from time to time, don't you? You put down the tech, you go away from the tech,
yes.
You go away from the connections. That's good advice?
I take a techno Shabbat. Actually, the American writer Tiffany Schlein first talked about this in the Harvard Business Review in 2013. I take techno Shabbat. You don't have to be Jewish. It helps, but you don't have to be Jewish on a Friday night. Switch it off. Lay the table for a meal with the family or with friends and go cold turkey offline for 24, 48 hours. It makes an enormous difference because, after all, our brains are human brains, not machine brains. We need to switch off and power down every now and then.
Julia, thank you very much for being with us this morning from London. We appreciate your time.
A pleasure. Bye.
Julia Hobswam, the author of Fully Connected, Surviving and Thriving in the Age of Overload. The book is published by Bloomsbury.
Hi, this is Jim Dahlke with today's Inno Minute on WGN Radio, a rundown of all the Chicago innovation and tech news you need to know, delivered by ChicagoInno.com. Tech.co, previously known as Tech Cocktail, has been acquired by UK-based digital marketing firm MVF. Tech Cocktail launched in 2006 as a way to connect Chicago's emerging tech ecosystem through events and tech news. And Chicago-based G2 Crowd just published its annual list of the 100 best software companies of the year, and the rankings feature plenty of familiar faces, including a few Chicago companies such as Basecamp, ActiveCampaign, and Sprout Social. That's today's Inno Minute from WGN Radio. Learn more at ChicagoInno.com and sign up for The Beat, our daily email newsletter.
WGN Radio's daily conversation about the life of business and the business of life. This is The Opening Bell with Steve Grzanich on 720 WGN.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome back to the program. As you know, Chicago is front and center in two global movements arising from the era of Trump. One is a legal challenge to immigration laws challenging the city's sanctuary status and the possible withholding of federal funds to the city. The other is driving a new conversation on the environment and climate change following the U.S. pullout of the Paris Climate Accord. Both are examples of a new trend called localism, shifting power to local communities. One of the authors of a new book is with us today to talk more about this. The book is called The New Localism, How Cities Can Thrive in the Age of Populism. It's written by Bruce Katz, who is a Brookings Institution Centennial Scholar, and Bruce is with us this morning. Bruce, good morning.
Hey, Steve. Thanks for having me.
Am I right in that these two examples I mentioned are included in this new localism? There are other examples all across the country, aren't there?
There are many examples. I think what is happening in the United States and, frankly, in places in Europe and elsewhere is that responsibility for dealing with the hard challenges facing our country, whether it's the challenges you describe or, frankly, investing in the future, who's going to invest in infrastructure, who's going to invest in our children, all that responsibility is being pushed down in the U.S. in particular to cities, counties, and metropolitan areas. And our book basically talks about the places that are stepping up, not just governments, but networks of public, private, civic institutions and leaders, and getting the job done.
Is this something new? Is this new? Is this all completely new, or has this happened before in our history?
Well, frankly, if you go back to the 19th century, to some extent, cities and states built the country because the federal government was so small. And then you saw that federal government balloon in the 20th century. What we're describing is a trend that's really been underway for several decades, because the federal government in particular and many states like yours have basically withdrawn from the game in many parts of domestic life. And cities and counties have had to sort of figure out how to move to this new kind of governance where it's not just the mayor and the county executive, but business leaders, heads of philanthropy, heads of universities, labor, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, the reason why cities are so powerful is that, again, they're networks, not government. They can't be hijacked by partisanship, and they're not generally riven by ideological polarization. And they have market power and civic power, not just governmental power. So I think we're in a new world here. And I think in the next several years, we will be inventing new financial mechanisms, new kinds of institutions, or repurposing old institutions to, again, fund the future, deal with these hard challenges.
Do you think that our governments will look completely different in that period of time? Do you think we'll have a new model for doing things completely?
I think we're going to have a very different model. The book talks particularly on the financing side of what's been happening in places like Copenhagen and Hamburg and Singapore and Hong Kong. I think the way in which governments understand what they own, the real estate, the buildings, not just what they owe, the pension liabilities, and how they leverage what they own, as they've done in Copenhagen. You know, in Copenhagen, what they did is they took all the public land around our waterfront, put it into one publicly owned, professionally managed corporation, and the yield from that management of those assets is now building an entire transit system for the city, not $1 of taxes, all done from land sales, land leases. That's a different model. I think that model is going to be in the United States.
And there are other examples, too. I know you write about Indianapolis and Pittsburgh. Indianapolis is sort of a mid to a smaller comparison to Chicago and Copenhagen, but it's an example of how this goes all the way down the list of cities.
Yeah, I think in Indianapolis, it's a remarkable story of how the CEOs of the major companies and philanthropies and universities came together. They formed a new entity, Central Indiana Corporate Partnership. They backed it with hundreds of millions of dollars of private and civic capital. And they're now steering and stewarding their economy. Indiana is the second largest exporter of life science products in the United States after California. And part of that really owes to the fact that these business, civic, and university leaders meet to decide, not to discuss. That's a different model of collaborative governance, and I think that's going to blow through the country as well.
You know, you talk about the market capital here, the amount of money that cities like Chicago and Los Angeles and Copenhagen, Indianapolis have to spend. That can get a lot of attention and change a lot of minds, can't it?
Well, I think most of our view of cities is that they're broke because we only focus on the government and we don't focus on the market side. And we don't focus on different ways in which the public and the private or the private and the public could actually work together to unlock capital. So I'm very bullish about what's going to happen to a lot of our cities. And, you know, we talk about Chicago in the book quite a bit because what Mayor Emanuel has done around community colleges and making them more relevant to companies in terms of the skills they teach, that's a model that also is being looked at, frankly, by many cities, not just in the U.S., but outside the U.S.
This is positive for our community. It's positive for the people who live here, our children. But there's also a possibility for investors to make money, is there not?
There's a huge possibility for investors to make money. It really depends what you're investing in. A lot of the capital that we're describing in the book, whether it's the public capital, the public wealth, so to speak, in Copenhagen, or the private and civic resources in places like Indianapolis and Pittsburgh, that's patient equity. Those investors are waiting for a much bigger return down the line because they know if they invest in their community, particularly in these growth hubs around waterfronts, downtowns, midtowns, where the University of Chicago is, they know there's going to be huge payoff down the line. So, you know, the investors we're describing in the book have patience and they have a long-term vision. And we have to get back to that in the United States. There's too much short-termism, both in the market side, but also in our politics, which is just focused on the next electoral cycle.
You know, and that's the next question here, Bruce. Is this a short-term trend that will maybe be over when the federal government becomes less dysfunctional? Or is do you see this as a permanent trend?
I think this is structural. I think the challenges we face today, or any challenge, whether it's climate or the economy or social inclusion, are multidimensional, and they need cross-sector interdisciplinary responses, and that's what happens in cities. It does not happen at the national level. And by the way, the national government is going to be dysfunctional for quite some time because many of the experts who reside in many of their agencies are leaving in droves, and there's no discretion left at the federal government. It's essentially a health insurance company with an army. And so a small philanthropy in Chicago has more discretion than a cabinet secretary in Washington. That won't change anytime soon.
Bruce, a very interesting topic. I wish we could spend all morning talking about this, but we'll tell people to pick up the book because it's a good one. We appreciate your time this morning, and best of luck with it.
No, thanks, Steve. I really appreciate the opportunity.
Bruce Katz is from the Brookings Institution, a centennial scholar there, and co-author of The New Localism, How Cities Can Thrive in the Age of Populism. He is a writer of this book Jeremy Nowak is his co-author on this. Wonderful book. Pick it up.
You're listening to The Opening Bell on 720 WGN.
On the WGN Associated Bank Market Desk, Dow futures are up 143 points this morning. NASDAQ futures are up 27. S&P futures are positive as well. Let's get the latest on agriculture and commodities now. Here's Orion Samuelson.
Good morning, Steve. Wheat futures at the Board of Trade fell to a one-month low yesterday, again pressured by global wheat supplies and a government report on Friday that said U.S. farmers planted more winter wheat this season than had been expected. Soybeans climbed to a one-week high on short covering and concerns that dry conditions in Argentina could turn yields in the world's number three supplier. Corn edged up on short covering and spillover support from higher soybean prices. Taking a look at the livestock trade yesterday at the Mercantile Exchange, lean hog futures up nearly 3%, setting a contract high. Wholesale pork brought $80.71 a hundredweight. That was down 38 cents from Monday. Live cattle futures firmed for a third straight session, with the February contract pushing above its 200-day moving average. So we look forward to the end of the month when the National Cattlemen's Beef Association will be meeting for its convention in Phoenix, Arizona. Have a great day. I'm Orion Samuelson.
Thanks, Orion. You as well. On the WGN Associated Bank Market Desk Outlook for Wednesday, January 17th, a couple of things, economic reports today, industrial production and capacity utilization. We'll get the Federal Reserve Beige Book today. There's also some Supreme Court hearings on cases. And Facebook, YouTube, and Twitter officials are set to testify to a Senate Commerce Committee on terrorism and other issues. Secretary of State Tillerson concludes a Canada trip, co-hosting a meeting on North Korea, and the Senate Banking Committee votes on a federal Fed governor nominee, holds a hearing, too, on combating money laundering today. It's also earnings week. Bank of America, Goldman Sachs, Alcoa, Tiffany reporting holiday sales today. Tomorrow we'll get earnings from Morgan Stanley and IBM. And then on Friday, January, consumer sentiment released by the University of Michigan. Some of the things that could move the markets on this Wednesday, January 17th.